This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive Insurance, where drivers who switch could save hundreds on car insurance. Get your quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates.
Hey, y'all. You're listening to It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Brittany Luce. And today, we're going to talk about something pretty much all of us do, but none of us can agree on the rules. I'm talking about tipping. It's a topic that's been coming up for me a lot on social media because it seems a little more ever-present in life, too.
Everywhere you go now, you have to tip.
That's Ramtin Arablouei, one of the hosts of NPR's history show Throughline, where he did a deep dive on tipping.
It used to be that you would tip when you sat down for a meal, usually. But now, if you go to any kind of place like a Chipotle or any other place, there's a tipping option. There's like a kind of a surcharge on everything they're paying for now. So I think it's frustrating a lot of people.
In the last couple years, it seems like tipping etiquette has shifted. We're being asked to tip in more situations, on a bottle of water, for grab-and-go sandwiches. I've even been asked to tip at a corner store while grabbing snacks. While this may have something to do with more touchscreens taking our orders, there's also been a hot debate over how much to tip. Just last week, I saw fights on social media about how some people now consider 20% too small a tip. So today, we take a look at what causes tipping to get more common, what it says about this moment in history, and what it says about us as a nation. Ramtin, welcome to It's Been a Minute.
Thank you for having me, Brittany.
Oh, my pleasure. It's so exciting to have a pod cousin on the show.
Yeah, we are.
I'm excited to talk about what we're going to talk about today. Mm-hmm. I love talking about topics that we all interact with on a regular basis that make people extremely upset to unpack.
Yeah, very emotional, for sure.
Today, we're going to talk about tipping.
Yes.
Tipping feels almost essential to being like an American consumer. But tipping hasn't always been a part of the fabric of our country's economy. Like there was a time when it was considered un-American.
That's right.
When and why was that?
Yeah. So it's both an economic reality and a cultural reality. It's in our psychology. It's deep within us, this idea that we need to tip. And you're also right that if you look back at particularly at early American history, so the United States was established in many ways to be a break from Europe's culture, which was defined by feudalism. So this notion that you are stuck in the class you're born in, and there is a small elite class that's served by a class of serfs or workers, basically. Before there was even a restaurant culture, people would tip servants in their homes.
Yeah, like the country homes in the pre-industrial world, there weren't restaurants, but it was like the expectation that if somebody was serving you, you had to give them a little money.
Exactly. It was a way of showing how wealthy you were.
Kind of like now, a little bit in a certain
way. Well, that's what's kind of haunting and weird about all this is that there was an acknowledgement from Americans that it was un-American, it was un-Christian to put somebody in a servile position by giving them that tip, and that we shouldn't do that in the United States. People viewed tipping in the United States as distasteful, as flunkyism, that's one word people would use, or a shakedown. And when the Civil War ended, this is where it gets really, and this is continually kind of gets dark. So there's this widespread acceptance that tipping is bad. Most Americans didn't tip. After the Civil War, so many enslaved people are now free and looking for work, right? So suddenly it becomes an opportunity for big companies and budding restaurants, which is a new industry that's evolving in the late 19th century. Companies are looking to essentially take advantage of all these workers who are now available, who are formerly enslaved, who don't have many rights. And so it's essentially they view it as cheap labor. And one famous person who did this is George Pullman, who owned the Pullman Railroads, basically. He was one of these kind of barons, basically, of the late 19th century. And he intentionally, after the Civil War, went and hired Black men. And particularly, he was very open about this, Southern Black men, to come work as porters on his railroads.
I had a relative who was a Pullman porter.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, 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 yeah.
Interesting. That's so fascinating because the numbers, when you look at the numbers, it was thousands of young Black men took these jobs. Mm-hmm. One, because there wasn't many other jobs available. That's number one. Number two, it was a way to see the country. It was, especially if you're young, it's a way to get away from where you lived, right? Because you get to travel across the country and work. But part of this was that Pullman saved on wages. He would pay most average wage for someone at that time was about $27 a month that he would pay, which even for then was nothing.
And the rest is supposed to be made up with tips.
The expectation was railroad porters would smile at the customers, would provide good customer service.
Right.
And he was in the process creating this fantasy for the budding, mostly white middle class that you could be treated like a king or queen of your castle, basically, while you're on the train. Even though you can't afford to have servants at home, you can kind of have that experience while you're on the train.
The idea that, like, people couldn't afford to have a servant or staff in their house, but they could get it on the train, that makes me think so much about Postmates, Uber Eats, all of those apps that link you with somebody, or Uber, for instance. If you can't afford a driver, you can request in the app if they speak to you or not, or what temperature you want.
Yes.
That psychology of why the Pullman porters might be appealing to, like, white middle-class Americans feels very familiar.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely.
It feels very familiar.
I mean, today, in a lot of ways, we have the same sort of inequality in the demographics of who's doing the serving as a job. Who is right. in that position? But it also, and this is just my personal opinion, it points to a psychological contradiction in American culture, which is on the one hand, we want to see each other as a country of equals, egalitarianism, meritocracy, these ideas that we're not like the old world. You're not set in one place. You can pull yourself up by the bootstraps, etc. But we also want to experience what it's like to be at the top of the feudal food chain.
You know, it's got me thinking so much about just the concept of customer service and like how loaded of a concept that is. I can't really decouple customer service expectations from this callback to another time where the racial caste system in America was more strongly enforced, like where a Southern Black man working as a Pullman porter could be severely underpaid and also seen as the ideal servant. You know, the smiling, the caring things. It makes me think so much about like some of the customer meltdowns, I think, that we all see on social media from time to time, when people feel as if they haven't gotten it their way, to quote Burger King, circa the 90s.
Yes.
You know, the customer is always right. Like, all it's so much of that is baked into our culture. But it's, you know, learning the history, it's very hard to decouple those things and to kind of pull all that apart.
I agree. And I think the tipping is the currency of that customer service setup that you just talked about. You know, I actually want to say one thing, that it's not all doom and gloom. There has been anti-tipping movements in America's past, very strong ones. And in fact, there's a book called The Itching Palm that was written in 1916 by a guy named William Rufus Scott.
Yeah.
It was almost like the kind of communist manifesto for anti-tipping. It's a manifesto against tipping. There's actually a quote from it I'd read, which I think really sums it up, if that's okay.
Yeah, go for it.
So Scott wrote in the book, "The theory of Americanism requires that every citizen shall possess this quality. Tipping is the price of pride. It is what one American is willing to pay to induce another American to acknowledge inferiority. It represents the root of aristocracy budding anew in the hearts of those who publicly renounce the system and all its works. The relation of a man giving a tip and a man accepting it is as undemocratic as the relation of master and slave. This is elementary." This was in 1916. The idea that this movement began then and has been kind of pushing, and there's anti-tip movements today, or I wouldn't even call them anti-tip, I would say pro-living wage movements, where people say you should be able to provide a living wage. And if you want to tip someone on top of that, well, that's a different kind of cultural thing. But no one should need a tip to survive. We're still having this debate and this discussion, whereas in Europe, for example, they made the conscious decision in most countries to include a kind of labor surcharge. That's why you don't have to worry about it, because it's already in your bill. You're already paying for the person who serves you food. It's part of it.
I wonder, like, how does all of that play into the politics around tipping?
Basically, in the middle of the 20th century, the United States made a conscious decision to freeze wages at a certain rate for restaurant workers. So after the Great Depression happens, FDR comes along, the minimum wage is put into place. There was no minimum wage until the 1930s. But one thing that's not talked about is that restaurants were excluded from that minimum wage, basically from the beginning. And the first National Restaurant Association was established in 1919. So they were lobbying to be excluded. Mm. And they were successful in 1919. They were successful in 1966, where there was an amendment to the minimum wage bill. And in the process of amending it, they calculated a minimum wage that was different, basically a sub-minimum wage for restaurant workers. And the last time they froze it was 1996 at $2.13 an hour.
Right.
So it's $2.13 an hour right now as a minimum wage for restaurant workers.
Federally, right. And the rest is supposed to be made up with tips.
So essentially what the restaurant industry has done is say, instead of paying our workers, what we're going to do is going to take that cost and put it on the consumer. You are responsible for taking care of the people who work for us or making sure that they are paid.
You know, I think a lot of us were confronted with that during the pandemic over the past few years. We got the messaging that it's hard to be a small business. And, you know, like these workers, whether they're at the grocery store, they're delivery workers, restaurant workers, they're not getting hazard pay to be there during the pandemic. I wonder, like, how do you think about a shift in tipping culture as like a fallout from the pandemic?
What's interesting is we kind of have been here before in another moment of economic difficulty. So the pandemic, obviously, it was a very difficult economic time. And the other moment where tipping took off, interestingly, was around the Great Depression in the early 20th century and Prohibition and around that time. Mm. So similarly, in a moment where restaurants' revenues were down because you couldn't sell alcohol, tipping became a way for restaurants to make up the difference in terms of their wages to their workers. Every time there's a economic downturn and suddenly it's more difficult to have a small business or any business, there's an acceptance of this pushing of responsibility to consumers. We're told that this is the only way our economy will survive. But where's the conversation about the responsibility for the larger companies to do this in particular? Like, let's just use an example of some of these tech companies that do food delivery services,
right?
Their fundamental business model is to take the risk and shift it onto the worker and then shift a significant amount of the pay onto the consumer. And they say, we're just the middle person. We're just the tech company in the middle. But why aren't we having a conversation about how much they should chip in? Whether there should be an increase, whether these businesses should even exist as they are. Because in my opinion, essentially what they're doing is they're gaming loopholes within our system and what we're willing to accept in order to have companies. And we have to have a conversation. Should those companies exist? If a restaurant can't pay its workers, should it exist? And this is a difficult conversation. I'm honestly asking it more than answering it because I know there's a whole bunch of fallout that can come from that. But I don't think we're even having that conversation about responsibility and who bears the responsibility.
I've been curious about anti-tipping movements for a while. And I remember reading an op-ed piece written by, I believe, a restaurant owner and chef who changed their restaurant so that all of the servers would get a living wage. So they would be tip free, like no tip restaurant. They were surprised by what happened, which was that as an individual restaurant, some of their servers were really unhappy with that because through the tipping system, they felt like if I hustle a little more or if I get a certain amount of tables, you know, I'm going to make more money that night. And they ended up in a position where they weren't able to be as competitive as other restaurants that had kept tipping. I don't think that that's necessarily an indication that like tipping should continue to be a practice the way that it is now. But I thought it was interesting that kind of made it clear how difficult of a problem this is for an individual restaurant to address. What do you see as a way out of our current tipping system? Like, where do we go?
Yeah, you know, it is complicated. And I think it varies from restaurant to restaurant and don't want to oversimplify at all. But when we did this episode, we looked into the actual research around this that people have done. And the truth is that maybe at the higher end restaurants, waiters feel like anti-tipping kind of hurts their wages to some extent. And, and that may be true. That's not the vast majority of restaurants. The vast majority of restaurants are for working class people. For those workers, of course, it's a better deal to have a working wage.
What do you think our current culture of tipping says about our society?
I don't think it says good things. I think it says two main things. It reflects on a very poor attitude towards workers and worker organizing. Fundamental needs of labor are not our priority, even though the vast majority of us are workers.
Hmm.
And the second thing, our attitude towards tipping, in my opinion, shows what our attitude towards poor people of color is in this country. But a large portion of that population are either poor or they're people of color or they're both. We are willing to accept this fundamental contradiction and, in my opinion, unfairness and cruelty as long as we're able to get our goods and services in the time we want to get them, with the level of service we want to get them, and to our satisfaction. And ultimately, we're willing to have somebody else in a position of inferiority towards us, and we may like it. We may want it because it makes each of us as a consumer feel valued, feel like we're getting something for our money, and that for a very fleeting moment, like we talked about, we get to feel elite.
Well, Ramtin, thank you so much for coming and talking with me about this. This was so illuminating.
Thank you, Brittany.
Thanks again to Ramtin Arablouei, co-host of NPR's Throughline. You can hear their episode about tipping called Land of the Fee wherever you get your podcasts. It is so good. I highly recommend it. Up next, we dive deep into a service sector that people are calling deeply dysfunctional, even before the tip. Black hair braiding. Stick around.
This message comes from NPR sponsor REI Co-op. REI has gear, clothing, classes, and advice for camping and glamping, biking and hiking, axing and snacksing, backpacking, and another outdoor thing that rhymes with backpacking. Visit your local REI Co-op or REI.com for the million and one ways you can opt outside.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Homes.com. When you're home shopping as a parent, you have lots of questions about local schools. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by a dedicated in-house research team. It's also you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework. This message comes from NPR sponsor BritBox. Discover powerful new series like Three Little Birds and BAFTA-winning drama Time, starring Bella Ramsey, Tamara Lawrence, and Jodie Whittaker. Stream the best of British TV only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.
Is it possible to engineer our way out of the climate crisis? Some entrepreneurs want to shoot particles into the stratosphere to combat global warming. Experts say regulations on this technology aren't keeping up. The world of solar geoengineering on the latest episode of The Sunday Story from NPR's Up First podcast.
Picture this. After weeks of rain, the sun finally parts through the clouds. People are jogging in the streets. Your neck is sticky with sweat, and a sweet summertime jam plays in the distance. It's summertime. Your long-awaited vacation is next week, and the last thing you need to do is get your hair braided. So you open Instagram, search the hashtag for the style you want, and enter the world of the Instagram stylist.
If you're a Black girl who has tried to get her hair done in the past 2 or 3 years, you may have been a victim of this current epidemic of unprofessionalism that's going on with stylists these days.
The IG Stylist is a digital shorthand for social media savvy hairstylists who specialize in all the latest hair trends. Lace wigs, silk presses, human hair clip-ins, lock extensions, you name it, somebody on Instagram does it. But out of all the styles, box braids have become one of the most consistent points of tension between stylists and clients. There are countless videos, TikToks, and threads of clients who are fed up with what they feel is a complete lack of customer service. There's the booking rules,
I just called the Pennsylvania Cosmetology Board on a stylist because I just read through her booking rules and it says she charges an extra fee for 4C hair.
Little to no hair care.
This lady's prices go from $780 to $1,000 and it does not include a wash, does not include detangling. You have to come with your hair already blown out and straightened out.
And deeply confusing pricing structures.
Is the IRS aware of the fact that you guys are charging $1,000 for braids?
Every few scrolls, there are videos of clients recounting negative to downright infuriating experiences with hairstylists. Last-minute cancellations, no-shows, stylists who eat while doing hair, and stylists who double and triple book while still charging upwards of $500 for a braided style. On today's installment of our continuing segment, we're exploring what's behind these viral videos and answering a question on a lot of Black women's minds. Why does something as simple as getting your hair braided feel impossible? And is there a world where you could have an affordable, efficient, and fair place to get your hair braided? A Black supercuts of braids, if you will. Well, it turns out it's a lot more complicated than you think. So, dear listener, let's get some basics out of the way. Is it possible to have an affordable braider? Well, for many of us, one option is having your friend, your sister, or your cousin do it for free. But in my opinion, you've already paid handsomely for that by investing in the relationship. But there's also the question of if your cousin, your sister, or your friend can really deliver on what you're looking for.
I wanted to get the French curl braids that were popularized in West Africa and haven't fully come into like the American context, but it's starting to, and I had to figure out how to get the hair. I found it on Instagram.
This is Julesy, public historian and YouTuber. She's been one of the few people online dissecting the IG stylist conundrum through a historical and economic framework.
Think about yourself at 19, 20 and like, oh, I just want to make $25 an hour. And it's not $25 an hour anymore, so you can make six figures.
And to make a lot of money, these IG stylists have got to charge a lot of money, which not every customer is willing to pay.
They're not the majority, but I do know some stylists who do charge close to $1,000.
Now, there are stylists out there who price fairly, have excellent customer service, and do beautiful work. I've been with my hairstylist for over a decade for this reason, but many of those stylists require advanced bookings to stay on schedule, and a lot of customers are looking for drop-in, same-day service. And those who want fast and affordable same-day braiding services often turn to the braiders at their local African braiding salon. These salons tend to employ African immigrant women who can braid hair fast and cheap, which might sound good to the consumer, but your experience and results may vary. And Julesy says, depending on the salon, there are ethical issues to think about.
You have 3-4 people on your head and you pay $200. How are they getting paid? I don't think you shouldn't promote the African hair salon. There's African hair salons that I go to that they charge in the regular rate everybody else is charging. But the ones that are doing like knotless, 5 people on your head, you're getting out this at a very low cost. Spidey senses go off.
Hair braiding is ultimately a business. You know that, I know that, but some of us are not acknowledging that with business comes a transactional relationship. Both client and stylist will always want to maximize profit and minimize expense.
One wants to make money, and so that's their focal point, and one wants the lowest cost possible to the highest quality service. And so I do think there are some justifiable complaints that stylists hold about how consumers engage with them. And I think on the consumer side, there are very legitimate complaints about the lack of customer service that is happening because everybody's trying to cut corners.
But not so fast. There's another factor we haven't addressed: supply and demand. And there's one lawyer who thinks that the supply of hair braiders is being artificially squeezed through licensing requirements and the steep penalties for braiding without one.
For instance, in New York, your first offense for working without a license could be up to $500. And then as those rise, you know, the highest amount that they could charge you is $2,500. Or you could be faced with a misdemeanor and you could be imprisoned for up to 6 months.
This is Jessica Poitras, legislative counsel for the Institute for Justice. a nonprofit organization that has been representing hair braiders in the fights against what she sees as unfair licensing laws.
Yeah, you could be imprisoned up to 6 months.
And licensing laws don't just impact who is allowed to braid. It also limits what some hair braiders are allowed to do. Take, for example, the viral fury over hair braiders not washing their clients' hair. Turns out that might be a legal issue.
And in every state, the definition's a little bit different. But for the most part, there are some braiders in some states that can braid hair, but they can't wash hair, right? Like that's the law.
Like it would be illegal if they washed your
hair. It would be illegal because shampooing hair falls within cosmetology and the braiding falls outside of that.
Now, I think most people's next question would be, so why not get licensed? That'll solve everything. Not quite. Coming up, Jessica tells us why she's fighting for braiders to be exempt from cosmetology licensing.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sell without needing to code or design. Just bring your best ideas and Shopify will help you open up shop. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR. Support for NPR and the following message come from Sattva. Sattva luxury mattresses are every bit as elegant as the most expensive brands, but because they're sold online, they're about half the price. Visit SAATVA.com/NPR and save an additional $200.
Do you ever wish you could get your stories in 3 hours rather than 3 minutes? Or maybe you're sick of doom scrolling, getting your news in bits and pieces. That is where Embedded comes in. We bring you documentary series that will change the way you think about things. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
On Wildcard, the new podcast from NPR, you'll hear people like comedian Jenny Slate reflect on their lives. What is something you think about very differently today than you did 10 years ago?
Dressing, like not salad dressing. I've always loved it and I'll never stop. Dressing my body.
That's all part of the new game show Wildcard, only from NPR. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, let me clarify. Not every state requires a license to braid hair. Many states have changed the laws recently and gotten rid of the requirement, Montana being the most recent. Now there are 33 states where you can operate without a license. But where I live, in New York, while braiders do not need a full cosmetology license, they do need a special braiding license. And to get that, you need a minimum of 300 training hours.
In a perfect world, there would be a school that would offer just that 300 hours, right? But schools don't have an incentive to offer specific training for these small specialty licenses, especially hair braiding. And so we have people who are working as hair braiders in what we call underground economies, right? So they are faced with two options: work without a license, which is illegal, or go through a traditional cosmetology program. Those sorts of things increase costs for consumers as well, right? That's how all businesses work. You're not just paying for the actual service that you're getting, you're paying for how they trained, learned, their experience, their knowledge base to be able to give you that service in that time and in a manner that you find suitable.
So if a hair braider wants to go the legal route, they might face a number of barriers. They'll need to pass exams, which are mostly in English. And tuition can cost around $15,000, depending on where they are. They'll need to find the time to attend classes, and they will need to learn skills that have zero connection to the one thing they may want to do. Braid.
Hair braiding, as you and I both know, right, is a cultural and traditional grooming hair care technique for Black Americans and persons of African descent.
It's a skill that's passed socially as opposed to formally. So like you might learn it from like a mother, sister, cousin, something like that, as opposed to in a classroom at a beauty school. I can understand why a stylist would need to go to beauty school to even learn the process of dyeing hair and then to also apprentice under a stylist. Like you could burn someone's scalp off or improperly mix reactive chemicals. But are there risks to braiding?
There are risks associated with doing everything in the world, mm-hmm. right? But hair braiding very specifically is a very safe technique and skill. As Black women, we know it to be a protective style, right? Like kind of the whole point of getting sun braiding services for some women is to be able to wear a protective style that protects our hair and allows it to grow. And I always like to say that, especially with the work that I do, is unlicensed does not mean untrained. Mm. We want our braiders, we want consumers to be trained. We are very pro-education. We just want you to get that education in a way that benefits you and your consumers. So if you already have the skill, great. You shouldn't have to go to school. But if you do need the skills, we want you to be able to find that training and have that training available. But the current system, the way that it's set up, it's just not readily available for hair braiders.
Are there other types of skills, like maybe business management skills that are taught in cosmetology school that would be useful for braiders?
Having any sort of training on how to run a business would be great. The problem is we don't require that of other businesses, right? So if you want to open up a restaurant, we don't require people to go to business school to learn how to run a restaurant and how to keep books for a restaurant.
Gosh. Jessica, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Jessica Poitras, Legislative Counsel for the Institute for Justice. So we've heard the client's perspective. We've heard the legal perspective. But what about the stylist's perspective? To understand what goes into the actual cost of braiding and how we might get closer towards an ideal for everyone, we called up a real-life stylist. And she has a license. Her name is Teray Rimple of Teray's Hair Beauty in Brooklyn, New York. Teray, welcome to It's Been a Minute.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Okay, so you are a licensed hair braider, hairstylist, but you had braided hair before you got your license. What made you decide to get the license?
So for me personally, I kind of slid into it. And as I saw myself going full time and getting more clients, expanding and whatnot, I kind of wanted to legitimize it for myself.
So you ended up actually going beyond the minimum requirement for New York State, which is getting a natural hair braiding license. You went to cosmetology school, but I have to ask, did they teach hair braiding at cosmetology school?
They had it on the syllabus. I would say that they did have it on the syllabus, just basic braids. However, when I went there, I kind of ended up teaching the braiding and, you know, going a little further with it, the cornrows and whatnot, because even the teacher there, he wasn't that much of a braider. And so he saw what I could do and he was just like, okay, you need to help me out with this. So no, and it wasn't on the state board either. Wow. Yeah, it wasn't on the state board. You didn't really need to know how to braid in order to get the license.
I imagine you paid tuition.
I did.
To attend cosmetology school. And then you ended up teaching.
Basically, yeah. Yeah. For that 1 week. Yes, I did.
So you didn't learn to braid at school, but did you get anything else out of cosmetology school?
I did learn more about like coloring and cuts. And also they taught me about valuing myself as a stylist.
It sounds like they did give you some guidance then about like professionalism and how to set boundaries.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
What about like other aspects of business, like basic accounting, scheduling, things like that? Was that also part of the mix?
No, not that I could remember. Granted, I got my license a few years ago, so I might not remember every single thing. Mm.
You are aware of the climate right now online.
Absolutely.
I'm sure, seen the videos and the rants and the threads and everything. What do you think clients misunderstand about braiding as a profession?
I think they don't put as much value as they should on their stylist, and they don't really see that this is an art form that it took a while to learn, to master. It puts wear and tear on our bodies, on our feet, on our hands. We're standing up for hours. Wow. My hands, you know, sometimes more so back in the day, it would swell or get a little stiff. So I have to run cold water on them. Or when I'm walking outside in the winter, I put my hands outside of my jacket just so the cold can get to it. I also only use my hands for braiding. I don't open jars or do crazy heavy lifting with my fingers or my hands. Yeah. Yeah.
Wait, you don't open jars?
Not if it's hard to open. Like if I try to open it and it doesn't open right away.
You protect your money makers.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I feel like to that point, there's been a lot of talk about the cost of braiding services.
Mm-hmm.
What goes into the cost of braiding hair?
First and foremost, how long it's going to take me to do it. That's definitely something I have to consider because I'm on my feet for that whole time. Second of all is the time and energy that I put into learning and perfecting this hairstyle, this braiding. Mm. I'm not charging the same prices that I did 4 years ago, 5 years ago, because I'm better now. My work is neater now. It's a different quality to it. Also, products. Also, overhead expenses and also the program that I use for people to book their appointments on. Mm. And also tools. Like, you know, I have to use certain tools. My combs, my brushes, my blow dryers, my hot tools. Like, all of these things cost money.
Hmm. A lot of people ask each other, we're asking ourselves if braiding is a luxury. I wonder, do you see braiding as a luxury? And do you think that that has anything to do with the relationship between hair braiders and their clients?
To answer that question, I would say it's kind of like asking, do you see eating as a luxury? No. However, you can choose to eat at McDonald's or you can go to a steakhouse. So similar to hair braiding, I would say it can be a luxury. You know, everything is up to par, sort of say. Mm. Or you can go to your cousin or something, assuming that the cousin is not his hairstylist, but, you know, go to your cousin and it's like, they can give you some braids and, you know, it's fine. It gets the job done, but it's not the same experience. Mm-hmm. It might not be the same quality. It might not even last as long.
That's really interesting. That's a really good way to put it. It seems like where the disconnect is coming in is that there's like people who want the Michelin star experience for the McDonald's.
There we go. There we go. Absolutely. That's the key. Yes. 100%.
Teray, thank you so much for talking with me today. This was really great.
Thank you. I really enjoyed this conversation.
When we first started looking into the business of braiding, I wondered if a Black Supercuts, a polished, ethical environment where Black folks could get braided styles fast, cheap, and good, could ever be a solution to these issues. But now, I'm not even sure that's the right question. For the record, I do think some of the complaints clients have are completely fair. Not dealing with kinkier hair types or getting food in your hair are absolutely not okay. But after looking at the hair braid wars from so many different angles, it's clear that between inflation, restrictive licensing laws, and even painful injuries, braiders are up against way more than a lot of us realize. This isn't meant to excuse bad behavior from certain stylists, but in order for this industry and our cultural practice to thrive, we've got to treat its professionals with the respect they deserve. And whether you're getting waist-length braids or a medium-rare steak, now seems like a good time for us as consumers and as a society to reframe how we value labor and each other as people. Thanks again to Teray Rimple, Jessica Poitras from the Institute for Justice, and Julesy, whose video, Abolish the Instagram Stylist, can be found on YouTube.
Hey, Brittany.
Hey, Brittany.
Hey, Brittany.
Hey, Brittany. It's Martiz from St. Louis. I'm not sure if you're a Travis Scott fan, but his latest album, Utopia, dropped last week, and pretty good. I was expecting to hear him talk about what happened at Astroworld. He doesn't really say anything about it, the deaths at his concert or any of it. I'm wondering, one, have you heard the album? And two, do you think Travis should have said something about Astroworld?
Martiz, first of all, thank you so much for calling in. I really appreciate your question. This is something that's been on my mind, too. I mean, all the discourse around the new Travis Scott album has been pretty much what you've said. This album sounds great, but also it doesn't really touch on the Astroworld tragedy at all.
For those who don't know, the Astroworld tragedy took place in 2021, which was a concert festival that Travis Scott put on. During his performance, there were a bunch of people in the audience that bum rushed forward and 10 people were killed. It was just so deeply sad. Since then, though, Travis Scott's like PR strategy seems to have been to say nothing. But like you, I listened to the album to see what remark, if any, he would make about the tragedy, and I heard nothing. I suppose that, you know, maybe because of legal reasons, he might not be able to comment on the tragedy that happened. He still, though, with his music, had some opportunity to even poetically gesture at what it was like to be in the middle of this mass tragedy. I think about how Ariana Grande, quite a different situation, but how she addressed the Manchester bombing in her music. It's pretty surprising to kind of get the artistic version of essentially crickets. I wonder what it says about us as a public that we'll embrace new music without any sort of touching on a tragedy. I've enjoyed Travis Scott's music in the past. I just am not sure how to really engage in it in the future when something like this has kind of just been brushed under the rug. I think that's for everybody to figure out on their own what their individual listening relationship is going to be. But as for me, I think this might be my last go-round with Travis Scott. And to all of you listening, I want to know what you want to talk about too. Anything from the biggest pop culture story of the week to the newest bangers to the TV show everyone is talking about. If there's something everyone in your world is going on about, record a quick voice memo with your first name, location, and the topic, and send it to ibam@npr.org. That's ibam@npr.org. I cannot wait to hear what you want to talk about. This episode of It's Been a Minute was produced by
Barton Girdwood,
Alexis Williams,
Liam McBain,
Corey Antonio Rose.
Our editor is
Jessica Plachek.
Engineering support came from
Patrick Murray,
Neil Tevault.
We have fact-checking help from
Greta Pittinger,
Barclay Walsh.
Our executive producer is
Verilyn Williams.
Our VP of programming is
Yolanda Sanguini.
Our senior VP of programming is
Anya Grundman.
All right, that's all for this episode of It's Been a Minute from NPR. I'm Brittany Luce. Talk soon.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. With the Spark Cash Plus card, you earn unlimited 2% cash back on every purchase for your business. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus. Terms and conditions apply. This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. When you're carrying around a lot of stress, therapy is a safe space to get it off your chest. If you're considering therapy, give BetterHelp a try at BetterHelp.com/NPR to get 10% off your first month.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.